Today, designing tech with seniors in mind. Simplified tablet computers, phones with big buttons, health monitors. It's a burgeoning marketplace, attracting venture capital and startups, as well as established companies. We'll hear about that. And if you're going to design for elderly people, it may help to be one. So we're about to meet someone like that in Silicon Valley, of all places. Barbara Beskind defies the tech industry's reputation for being obsessed with youth. She is 90, and as NPR's Laura Seidel reports, she works for IDEO, a design and innovation consulting firm.
Designers solve practical problems. And as Barbara Beskind ages, she says being a designer can be very helpful.
Everybody who ages is going to be their own problem solver.
Beskind sits on a couch in an open office space at IDEO, filled with staff young enough to be her grandchildren. She commutes to the office once a week from a community for older adults where falling is a problem.
And people where I live fall a lot. Now, I started out for a friend of mine. I tried to design airbags of graded sizes that would be activated at a lurch of 15 degrees.
Beskind is stumped on how to find the right power source for her airbags. She says she started designing when she was 8 years old. Toys, of course.
Well, in the Depression, if you can't buy toys, you make them.
Beskind's first design was for a hobby horse.
I was determined I was going to have one, and so I made it with old tires. I learned a lot about gravity because I fell off so many times.
When it was time for college, Beskind told her counselor that she wanted to be an inventor. That required an engineering degree. In those days, women couldn't get into those departments. So she studied home economics and later enlisted in the Army, where she became an occupational therapist. After 44 years, she retired as a major, then went into private practice. From those years, she has 6 patents on inflatable devices that help children with balance issues. Beskind tried to retire again. 2 years ago, she was watching 60 Minutes. She saw David Kelly, the founder of IDEO, talking about how important it was to have a diverse staff on a design team.
That's the hard part, is the cultural thing of having a diverse group of people and having them be good at building on each other's ideas.
Beskind says the interview made her think she wanted to work at IDEO.
Oh, that sounds like that's for me. And besides that, I was living in Silicon Valley. What could be better?
Beskind wrote to the firm, and she heard back within days. It turns out that in the U.S. over the last couple of years, as baby boomers age, interest in designing products for older adults is growing. Gretchen Addy, an associate partner at IDEO, hired Beskind. She says when Beskind is in a room, young designers do think differently. For example, Addy says IDEO is working with a Japanese company on glasses to replace bifocals. With a simple hand gesture, they will turn from the farsighted prescription to the nearsighted one. Initially, the designers wanted to put small changeable batteries in it. Beskind pointed out to them that old fingers are not that nimble.
It really caused the design team to reflect on, you know, maybe it's just a USB connection. Are there ways that we can think about this differently?
IDEO employees like Jason Daler often tell Beskind that her energy is contagious.
I'm sitting here doing like a not very inspiring task of doing budgets, and like just listening to you talk and your attitude, I'm like, I got more into it.
Beskind has macular degeneration and only has peripheral vision. So she draws her designs with easy-to-see, thick black felt pens. She hands me a design for glasses that would help people like her. One of the features is that they take a photo as people walk up and introduce themselves. The glasses also have a small speaker.
So that the next time as you approach within 10 or 12 feet, something in my ear would say, it's Laura.
Beskind says, as she gets older and faces new problems in the world, she's thankful she's a designer.
It makes aging more tolerable, more enjoyable. Yeah, I mean, I enjoy the age I'm in. I think it's one of the best chapters of my life.
And for the bulging demographic of baby boomers growing old, Beskind has this advice: embrace change and design for it. Laura Seidel, NPR News.
Let's look next at weight loss. For extremely overweight people, bariatric surgery is highly effective. It reduces appetite by reducing the size of the stomach. But it is not always a lifelong cure. As NPR's Patty Naiman reports, a new procedure could help patients maintain their weight loss.
For most of her life, Fran Friedman struggled with compulsive eating. By the time she arrived at UCLA, she was 360 pounds at just 5'2".
So I opted to have the bariatric surgery.
And lost 175 pounds.
And maintained that for almost 10 years. The first time in my life that I've ever lost a lot of weight and was able to maintain it.
It was a miracle, says Friedman, not to feel hungry. The surgery reduces the stomach to about the size of an egg, and people feel full from very little food.
I thought that I was cured. I thought that I could eat like regular people.
But 10 years after the surgery, Friedman started gaining weight again. She felt confused and depressed. UCLA gastroenterologist Rabindra Watson says she's not alone. About one in three patients regain significant amounts of weight a few years after surgery to reduce the size of the stomach pouch.
And then over time, what we found is that the pouch can dilate and stretch. And when that pouch stretches, patients are able to eat more at one sitting and they feel hungrier more often.
At the same time, hormonal changes that reduce appetite and take effect pretty much immediately after surgery begin to decline.
The body, again, adapts to that change in physiology, and we think that possibly those changes are being reversed over time, though we don't have enough evidence to prove it.
These hormonal changes and a stretched-out stomach pouch mean people feel more hungry and are inclined to eat more. For Fran Friedman, it meant a 20-pound weight gain.
And then reality hits. Do I want to go back to where I was, or do I want to maintain this level of quality of life?
And this may be the hardest part of life after bariatric surgery, understanding that the surgery doesn't mean patients no longer have to pay attention to what they eat or whether they exercise. Gastroenterologist Watson says that's still a lifelong commitment. And for some patients like Fran Friedman, a new, less invasive procedure can make the stomach smaller again, and that can make a major difference.
By reducing the size of the pouch, what we found is that patients report improvement in their satiety and decrease in their hunger, and ultimately greater control over how they're eating.
And for Friedman, that did the trick. She's lost 30 pounds since that second surgery, and now with the help of a support group, she's committed to watching what she eats and how much she exercises. Patty Neiman, NPR News.
New York Times columnist Roger Cohen's family history covers a lot of ground, literally. His ancestors lived in Lithuania. Then, starting with his grandparents, the moving began.
My parents were born in South Africa, and they were immigrants in the UK, where I was born. And then when I was an infant, we went back to South Africa for a couple of years and then moved to Britain, where I mainly grew up. So in each of the past four generations, the family has moved. Lithuania, South Africa, London. I'm now an American citizen and consider New York to be home.
Cohen's new family memoir is called The Girl from Human Street. The girl in that title is Cohen's mother, a focus for much of the book. She died in 1999 after a long battle with depression.
My mother, shortly after we emigrated, immediately after my younger sister's birth, broke down. She had what was then called post-puerperal psychosis, now generally called postpartum depression. And she had insulin shock treatment since completely discredited. This is in the late 50s in England, and electroshock treatment. It was only in researching the book that I finally was able to put dates and times on this. And now know, for example, that on August 1, 1958, one day before my third birthday, she had this treatment. But she came back to the family after an intermittent absence of a couple of years, and a great effort was put into preserving an appearance of normality. And I was not aware, consciously aware, of what had happened to my mother until in my late teens she began to become mentally unstable again and was manic depressive for the rest of her life. First tried to commit suicide when I was 22. And I suppose a genesis of The Girl from Human Street, Arun, was it was a box in the attic, and in it were my mother's suicide notes, and my dad was a doctor, and there was a pretty detailed chronology of what had happened, and there was a family tree that he'd obviously made in a moment of desperation with black dots next to every family member who had suffered from manic depression, and there were more relatives with black dots than without them. And I began to think about how this family condition had been hidden within my own family, and then there was a wider story of our displacements with each generation and the trauma, if you like, of losing a home, of upheaval, of beginning again.
Can you talk about growing up in South Africa? Because you were in kind of an unusual position. You were sort of an English-Jewish family in South Africa in kind of an interesting time.
Yeah, well, my parents were South African Jews. They come from Lithuania. They grew up there. My dad came to England as a young doctor at the end of World War II and then went back. And he abhorred apartheid. He was actually the dean of the last black house within the University of the Witwatersrand in Johannesburg. And then he saw how, as a result of apartheid, black students were no longer able to attend. And that, for him, was the last straw. I lived there as an infant and then would go back every year. And there was always this faint menace at the horizon. The blacks were going to rise up and sweep away these beautiful homes where I stayed in Johannesburg. And I remember cousins saying to me, "Enjoy the swimming pool. Next year, they'll be red with blood." And I didn't quite get it. You know, sometimes I would sit on the wrong bench or wander into the wrong place because I was part of South Africa, but I wasn't from there. And of course, one of the particularities of apartheid was that blacks were banished, except in the most intimate of settings, the home, the family. Hmm. More or less every white family had black staff. And I would wonder why these utensils were set apart, and I would see them going to sleep in these little concrete outhouses with their baleful single windows. So there was this combination of intimacy, of closeness, and of threat, fear, menace always out there. And it gave me a profound abhorrence of this evil. You know, I spend a lot of time in the Middle East. I don't think Israel practices apartheid. Some people, when it comes to the Palestinians, some people use that phrase. But there are echoes. You know, when you're in the West Bank and you're on a road and it says only for Jews, only for settlers, only for Israelis and not for Palestinians, those echoes are there. And it's one of the reasons why I'm a Zionist who believes very strongly that Zionism must involve two states for two peoples.
You and your family had been through various upheavals, various new homes, and you come to America. Now, America is a place we like to think where it's easier to assimilate than a lot of other places in the world.
It is easier, Arun. That's why I love it. That's why I became an American citizen. You can't imagine what a relief it was as a Jew to arrive in New York City. And the bright star, as I think I put it in the book, of immigration, of moving on, is new opportunity. And its black sun is loss, the loss of a home, the loss of a country, the loss of a community. And for some people, the project of beginning again is overwhelming. It's too much. That was the case for my mother. Even in America, for me, it's hard. But even the most open of European societies has nothing like the openness of the United States, which is a country that is still, in my view, endlessly enriched by immigration.
Roger Cohen is a columnist for The New York Times. His new memoir is called The Girl from Human Street. Roger Cohen, real pleasure speaking with you. Thank you.
Thank you, Arun.
It is only January, but some college kids are already focused on this summer, especially students who want jobs in the tech industry. That's true for a group of college students in California's Salinas Valley. Most of them are the children of farm workers or are immigrants themselves. Krista Almanzan of member station KAZU first met the group of students about a year ago and caught up with them recently on campus.
Okay. So what you're saying is if they click it instead.
About an hour south of Silicon Valley, in a classroom at Hartnell Community College, Daniel Diaz and Brian Deanda stand at a whiteboard, mapping out ideas on how to reduce the size of a mobile app their team is building.
So if we do this, how much space are we going to knock out?
We don't know yet.
This isn't a class, and the app they're building, an informational guide for a drug rehab center, isn't even a school project. But this is what it takes to have a chance at an elite summer internship, says Daniel Diaz.
What you're taught at school is not enough, especially in today's competitive society. I think you need to do more outside learning.
So these students are working on other apps, doing hackathons, and learning additional programming languages outside of class because there's a thought, perhaps a reality, that hangs over them. They're underdogs. Elias Ramirez is also on the team.
Given the region it's in, it's majorly farm workers. So given that, you don't think that many bright students can come from you.
They're all part of the inaugural class of CSITN3, an intensive accelerated computer science degree program targeted at students from the agricultural Salinas Valley. They're about halfway through the three-year program where they've done much of their coursework at the community college and will soon be doing the majority at Cal State Monterey Bay, where they will ultimately earn their degree. Joe Welch is one of the program's co-founders.
We're going to bring a population that's not fully represented in Silicon Valley right now.
Welch is referring to diversity numbers that some major tech companies released last year, showing that when it comes to U.S.-based tech workers, the number of Hispanics or Blacks doesn't even come close to 5%. Women fare better, but still less than 20%. In the CSITN3 program, 90% of the students are Latino, and nearly half are women.
If they don't do anything to change the hiring processes that they've historically done, they'll be very challenged to get those trend lines to change at all, whether for women or whether for underrepresented minorities.
So Welch and his co-founder have been pitching Silicon Valley companies this: become our partner. We'll send you our best students. You'll give them internships. It's proving a hard sell to companies that have long-standing relationships with top-tier schools like nearby Stanford and UC Berkeley. But they've made some inroads.
Let's finish up and transition to our second group, which would be resume tips.
At a networking event in the ballroom of Cal State Monterey Bay, Welch watches as the students mingle with representatives from local companies and a few from Silicon Valley, including Google, Twitter, and Salesforce.
So next group, fire away.
About 10 students gather around Pat Patterson's table. He's with Salesforce. Patterson's interest in this program goes beyond this networking event. He also taught a course in the program this past semester. He says he's optimistic about CSITN3, both for its potential to quickly get graduates into the workforce and diversify the industry.
If your employees are almost a monoculture, they're going to be building products and taking into account the needs of that monoculture. So by having more diversity in tech, we can actually build better products that better serve the needs of the wider community.
And as students like Elias Ramirez will tell you, they also bring grit. When his parents first came to the U.S. from Mexico, they worked in the fields before moving on to better jobs. And that hard work has inspired him.
The idea that there might be someone better than me is what actually might keep me competitive.
So far, the CSITN3 students are getting interviews, and one of the 28 has secured an internship with Apple. For NPR News, I'm Krista Almanzon in Salinas, California.
The solar energy business is growing fast. Solar panel prices dropped more than half in the last 4 years. But government subsidies expire soon, and natural gas prices also keep dropping. Those things make the future of solar a little hazy. But for now, the industry is hiring. NPR's Jeff Brady reports a new survey shows more than 31,000 solar jobs were added last year.
Among those who became a solar industry worker last year is 54-year-old Charlie Wild of Denver.
It's really hard work, especially in the summertime when you're on those hot roofs.
Wild finished a training last spring, got certified, and then worked temp jobs as an installer. Now he's starting his own business called Ecology Solar.
I'm launching a marketing plan this month, and I'll be targeting people in my neighborhood of Denver, Colorado, and then expand out from there as the business grows.
He'll work on his own, but for people like Wild with experience, the pay is good. Andrea Lukey heads the Solar Foundation and says installers make about $22 an hour.
People in sales positions are making about $40 an hour. So these are good jobs. These are highly desirable jobs and jobs that are helping to positively contribute to the U.S. economy.
Lukey says there's work for roofers, electricians, and engineers, too. The U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics doesn't track solar industry employment, but the agency cites figures from Lukey's foundation. It released a census of solar industry employment last week.
We have nearly 174,000 solar jobs in the U.S., which is 22% more than last year and 86% more than when we first started to track jobs in 2010.
Lukey says solar makes up less than 1% of the energy consumed in the U.S. today. Two-thirds of the country's power still comes from coal and natural gas. Lukey says that leaves plenty of room for growth in coming years. There are a few big issues that could affect the solar industry's future, though. Solar companies still rely on a 30% federal tax credit to compete with those more established fossil fuels. That credit is scheduled to end in about 2 years. Jeff Brady, NPR News.
John Cruden served with U.S. Special Forces in Vietnam. He took his law school aptitude test while still in Saigon, and he later became a government lawyer. Now he's the new chief of the Environmental Division at the Justice Department. He gave his first interview to NPR Justice correspondent Carrie Johnson.
For John Cruden, the new role means coming home to a place where he worked as a career lawyer for 20 years. Cruden's been around long enough to have supervised the Exxon Valdez spill case, a record setter, until the Deepwater Horizon exploded in the Gulf of Mexico in 2010.
In most of our minds are those nearly 3 months of watching the impact of the spill, but also a gigantic economic effect.
This week, Cruden heads to New Orleans to oversee the next phase of the case against BP.
It clearly ranks up there as one of the most significant environmental disasters of our lifetime and deserves all of our energy to try to make sure nothing like this happens again.
The portfolio is sweeping, not just BP, but also defending core challenges to the administration's actions on climate change, a huge source of contention with many Republicans in Congress. Another priority, Cruden says, is to stop illegal trafficking of animals.
We should be fighting for the survival of some of the world's most protected and iconic species, and then working across the government and across the planet to end the illegal trade in wildlife.
This month, his prosecutors convicted an auction house in Florida for selling rhino horn, elephant ivory, and coral objects smuggled into China. He sees a symbol of that work every day in front of his office.
The huge bear that we have that was actually a trial exhibit in one of our cases, an endangered species. And so when the trial was over, we brought it here. And it's now famous.
Carrie Johnson, NPR News, Washington.